Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. My only guest today is Christopher Jenks, a sociologist who teaches at Harvard, one of our leading scholars of inequality, a topic that's been in the news a bit over the past year. Before all that, some words in the news. Since this is a turn-of-the-year show, a bit of the twin-faced Janus mode is obligatory. As the French say, plus ça change, plus ça la même chose. Or as we say in English, the more things change, the more they remain the same. There's always the hope that using the French will make it sound like less of a cliché, but of course the risk is that you sound pretentious instead. In the more they remain the same department, we learned from Thursday's Financial Times that some things that took a hit in the financial crisis are back in a big way. First, the so-called shadow banking sector. That's the name given to large financial operators outside the banking system, entities like hedge funds, private equity funds, money market funds, and the like, who have tons of money and power but are barely scrutinized, if at all, by regulators. Paradoxically, the post-crisis shrinkage of the banking sector, prompted by new rules restricting their speculative trading for their own account, and also by investors who think that the banks have gotten too big to be sufficiently profitable, the shrinkage is promoting the growth of non-bank institutions as assets shift. But despite their return to rapid growth, no serious figures are calling for the regulation of these shadowy characters. Even though they are huge, accounting for 25-30% of financial assets, systemically important, and given to reckless behavior. Something to worry about in 2012. And as another article on the same page of the FT, I'm old-fashioned, I still read it on newsprint, catastrophe bonds are making a comeback too. Cat bonds are issued by insurance companies, which face huge risks from unusual natural disasters. Unusual in the sense of those once-in-a-century events that now seem to be happening several times a year. Cat bonds pay high interest rates in normal times, but in the event of a catastrophe, like an earthquake or a hurricane, they can end up paying nothing. Cat bonds are a way for insurance companies to raise money for normal business and provide a cushion in the form of emergency non-payment in case things go seriously wrong. Cat bonds took a major hit during the financial crisis as investors got scared of risk, but we're now moving back into what's known in the jargon as a risk-on environment. What's odd about cat bonds, aside from the fact that buyers can end up with a haircut so severe that there's nothing left but scalp, is that they're a financial substitute for political action about climate change. About 15 years ago, I went to a conference co-sponsored by Greenpeace and the insurance industry. Greenpeace was trying to enlist insurers in the fight against climate change that's going to result in more frequent and more severe storms at great expense to the bottom line of insurers. The insurers, though, were mostly interested in tighter building codes and financial innovations like cat bonds. That seems to be where the insurers still are, alas, though there are a couple of exceptions in Europe. Also in the non-change department, despite a lot of talk to the contrary, the U.S. remains the leading safe haven in the capitalist world. Despite a ratings downgrade from S&P, U.S. Treasury bonds remain very popular with investors, especially, to use the jargon again, when they're in a risk-off mood. No other country offers the deep, liquid bond market that the U.S. does. We've heard a lot about how the dollar was in danger of losing its role as the world's principal currency, but there aren't any plausible rivals to that role at the moment. Chinese financial markets are hardly open to the outside world, and though that's likely to change over time, it's going to take years for the renminbi to become a world currency. The euro looked for a while like a rival to the dollar, but now it's nothing but a headache. The Japanese yen was thought to be a dollar rival in the 1980s, but the country still hasn't recovered from the bursting of its mega bubble 20 years ago. There's a distinction that's common in economics, but not so much in civilian speech, absolute versus relative. The absolute price of a gallon of gas is interesting if you're a driver, but its price relative to a train ticket is also important, if less talked about. Economists talk about relative prices all the time. Rent versus buy, beef versus salmon. Long ago, I saw a chart of the price of a Brooks Brothers suit denominated in the barrels of oil. The point was to compare the status of financial assets since Wall Street guys love Brooks Brothers suits, or at least used to, versus commodities like oil. I'd love to see an update of that chart, with oil now close to $100 a barrel. All that by way of saying that when we talk about the decline of the U.S., we have to ask, relative to what? And the answer isn't entirely clear. And now on to some real change. The Pew Research Center reports that in a recent poll, 50% of Americans have a positive view of capitalism and 40% a negative view. By contrast, 31% have a positive view of socialism and 60% a negative one. In other words, capitalism is 19 points more popular than socialism. Parenthetically, though, who could have imagined that a third of Americans would have a positive view of socialism? But things get interesting when you dig below the surface. Capitalism wins among white people by 31 points, but loses to socialism by 14 points among blacks and 12 points among Hispanics. It wins by 46 points among households with incomes above $75,000, but loses by 4 points with the under $30,000 set. Older Americans prefer capitalism by large margins, but those aged 18 to 29 give a higher rating to socialism by 3 percentage points. Several years ago, I saw today's younger generation described as the most left-leaning in the history of polling, and not just on cultural issues, but economic ones as well. This is further proof of that. And contrary to the cliché, people do not get more conservative as they age. People's political leanings are typically set for life by the time they're young adults. While I certainly do not wish ill on older Americans, I'm rapidly becoming one myself, this can only be a happy portent for the future. Oh, and Pew also reveals that 44% of the population supports Occupy Wall Street and 35% oppose. Not bad, really. And so we end 2011 and enter 2012 on a pretty encouraging political note, don't you think? Back to talk inequality with Christopher Jenks after a break. That was some of Rich Kid's Blues by Licka Lee from her 2011 album Wounded Rhymes. My guest today is Christopher Jenks, who's a professor of social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. I should say at the outset that he is my wife's uncle. I spend most major holidays with him, and I'm personally quite fond of him. His politics are softer than mine, but it's hard to be too militant with a loved one over the Christmas holiday. Christopher Jenks has been researching and writing about inequality, poverty, and living arrangements for well over 40 years. He didn't take a conventional route into academia. His first grown-up job was as an editor at the New Republic, back when it was an honorable liberal magazine in the early 1960s. He's since taught at, among other places, University of California, Santa Barbara, the University of Chicago, Northwestern, and done several stints at Harvard, where he is now. He's been on the editorial board of the American Prospect since 1989 and is one of the principal investigators on the Russell Sage Foundation's New Inequality Project. Here's Christopher Jenks, known to family and friends as Sandy. Welcome, Sandy. So you're not one of those scholars who thinks that the increase in inequality remains yet to be proved, are you?
No, I think we have pretty overwhelming evidence that it's real.
I figured. So it started late 60s, early 70s, we started moving in this direction?
We started moving in this direction for parents with kids in the late 60s. So that what happened to kids was getting you know, their opportunities were getting more unequal as time went on. But it didn't happen in the country as a whole for everybody until the 1980s. But the bottom was getting further from the middle among parents. So there were more and more kids who were a lot worse off than the average American studying the.
And why did it show up with kids first? Is something particular about the demographic of the kids, or is it a broader phenomenon?
We think it's mostly to do with the fact that there were more and more single parents, and those parents often didn't have any regular earner in the household, and they were depending on welfare and child support payments and that kind of thing. So those were not very adequate even then, and they kept falling, so that exacerbated the situation.
And then why did it spread to the broader population in the 80s?
Well, in the 80s, there was a spreading out of wages as well as the change in demography kept going, but also the wage inequality was going up, so that the wages at the bottom, they stopped raising the minimum wage after Reagan came in, and the wages in the bottom half of the distribution pulled away or stagnated, really, fell a little bit sometimes. And everybody else's wages were going up a bit, so the inequality in the bottom half got even wider. And then in the mid-80s, after the Tax Reform Act, there was a kind of the beginnings of the takeoff of incomes at the top half of the distribution and the rise of the top 1%. But more generally, the top 20% or 10% were doing better in the 80s and early 90s, at least.
Do you think the changes in the tax code had effect on pre-tax income distributions?
They had a short-term effect on the pre-tax distributions because a lot of people started taking their capital gains after the capital gain. When the capital gains tax rates changed, it became obvious to people in 1986 that they should take their capital gains right now before the Tax Reform Act went into effect. But that's a temporary effect. But I think that the evolution of the tax code made it make more sense to pay people a lot of money, either as stock options or as cash or both in many cases, and because the tax rates were somewhat lower, and so you thought you were going to get more motivation per dollar of what you laid out if the tax rate was going to be either at the capital gains rate or even if it was going to be in the 30 to 35% bracket instead of the 45% bracket. I mean, we've gone steadily down in our taxes at the top, and that makes it seem steadily more plausible when somebody is thinking about what do they want to say, well, I want another $1 million or half a million or whatever it is, because they're going to get to keep more of it. And people respond to the idea that they're going to get to keep more of it.
Now, I've seen it said that, to use the jargon of the trade, that the increase in inequality has both been driven by within-cell and between-cell inequality. That is, people of similar demographic mm-hmm. characteristics are showing more inequality, also people of different demographic characteristics showing greater inequality. Do you agree with that?
That's largely true. That's partly true because we probably don't have the right cells. I mean, that is the reasons why people are more unequal within categories could be to do with the skills we don't measure, whereas they're more unequal between cells because of the skills we do measure, like education and test scores. So if you're good at selling automobiles to people, it probably doesn't have that much to do with education or test scores, but with other skills. But even so, there's an incentive to reward people who are good at selling cars and not reward the ones who aren't so good, and so it pulls the wage distribution apart once the norm is that you're going to pay people by how many cars they sell. But they don't exactly do that, but that's another story.
That probably would have been true even 40 years ago, so why there's the magnification of inequality within cell?
I think it's mostly that the social norms have changed about what it's appropriate to do for some people, and then other people think they need to keep up. So if CEOs are making fabulous salaries, then other people who are negotiating for salaries think, well, if they make that much, I can get that much, I should get that much too. There's much less sense of, I don't know, that there's less sense anywhere in the society that there's anything wrong with demanding more money as opposed to something lower key and less obvious. I had a friend who studied Switzerland at one time and said, well, I said, so why is the Swiss distribution of income so unequal when it looks like Switzerland is a pretty equal place when you go there? And he said, oh, the Swiss really hate it when people consume conspicuously. So the rich people in Switzerland build houses that nobody can see. They build them way up in the mountains, or they build them on the Riviera, or they build them in the Caribbean or whatever. They live just as opulently as people in other countries, but it's not appropriate to do that in public. Well, that has the effect, of course, also that it provokes less envy. So lots of other Swiss don't think they need to have that much money because they're not watching people living much better than them, and they're not trying to keep up perhaps as much as they would be if they were living in the middle of Manhattan.
Also, Switzerland doesn't have the extreme of poverty that we do in the United States.
That's correct.
Yeah, how much of the increase in inequality is the result of the poor getting poorer?
From about 1968 through 1985 or something like that, most of it was at the bottom. It was that the poor were either getting poorer, which was somewhat true, but what they really weren't doing was keeping up, because the middle was going up gradually, not a lot, but some. And the poor were getting somewhat poorer during that period because of family structure and because of the minimum wage lagging behind inflation in the early 80s and that kind of thing. Since the mid-80s, it's mostly been at the top, certainly since the early 90s. If you look at how the bottom did compared to the middle in the 90s, they actually did a little better.
The late 90s?
Or? The late 90s, it kind of... Even in the late 90s,
well,
there was some...
across the board wage increases for just about everybody in the late 90s, right?
But the relative wages of people at the bottom made slight progress. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate this, but it was slightly better during the Clinton years. Then that's been reversed since then. But it was some improvement during that period. But basically, if you go back to the mid-80s and compare it to 2007 before the crash, the bottom to the middle doesn't look like it's changed all that much. And what really looks like it's changed totally is what's going on at the very top of the distribution, the top.
All right, let's talk about the proverbial 1%. who are these folks?
There are not as many of them who are bankers and financiers as I had thought when I first started to look at it, because looking around, those are the people you see the most of. But, of course, there are a lot of CEOs. But there are also doctors and lawyers and so forth, at least if you're talking about the 1%. Now, if you dig a little deeper, if you say, well, most of what happened to the top 1%, not all, but most of it, it was the top 10th of 1%, one person in 1,000 instead of one in 100. And when you get to those people, the doctors and the lawyers don't show up so much, and nor do, this is much more likely to be people with big capital assets and gains, businessmen who've made good, hedge fund people who had a good year or a good 2 or 3 or 5 years, and people who own shares in startup companies that have done really well. I don't know how many of the people in the top 10th of 1% are people who made money in Silicon Valley, but it's certainly not a trivial percentage. But
it's a pretty small population.
Yes, it's a very small population. And, when you get down, you only get to those people when you get to, you shave this closer and closer, the top 10th of 1%, the top 100th of 1%. And even when you get to the top 100th, it's a little dicey to know how much confidence to have in those numbers, but they are the numbers that the IRS produces. They're not numbers that come from surveys.
Right, but then also very rich people are clever at hiding their income.
Absolutely.
So we don't even know what's going on.
Yes, I agree.
I'm speaking with Christopher Jenks, who is a professor of public policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard. We talked a bit about this, the instability at the top. Is it a matter of people who just land there for a year and then fall back maybe to the 98th percentile? How prevalent is that?
This work I've seen suggests that there's some of that, but not as much as people argued originally. When people first started noticing this huge increase in the share for 1 year, they said, well, gee, a lot of this is capital gains, which it was. And capital gains often, you know, you take them, but you take them in 1 year because you sold your company or something. But the work that's I've seen recently suggests that there's nowhere near as much turnover at the top as you might at first think. That seems to suggest, although I don't know if it's right, that people who take capital gains in 1 year actually have a lot of capital gains, and they take some of it 1 year, and they take some of it the next year, and
they have a lot of capital.
Yeah, there's a lot of capital, and when there's any gains to be had, you know, they can elect when to take it.
And then capital gains are a large portion of their income from year to year?
For some people. For CEOs, for instance, it's more. There's going to be stock options usually, rather than you know those
which get recorded as income and not.
Those are recorded as income. This is some. Their compensation. Why
for the great work they do?
Yes, right. Or the great work they did. The rationale for the distinction is a little elusive to me, but it's the reverse of the hedge fund people getting to call their. Huge paychecks, capital gains, and get them taxed lower. What you might think of those stock options as being capital gains, and therefore think, well, why haven't they got them treated as capital gains? Apparently, they haven't.
Now, there's a perception around that the middle ranks are emptying out, and some are heading upwards, and more heading downwards. Is that a fair characterization?
In some sense, it's got to be the case if the richer getting richer and nothing else is changing that much, that the middle ranks are going to thin out a little, but then numerically they won't thin out too much. It's just that they're lagging further and further behind, so maybe they don't look so middly. The bottom has not grown that much in the last 25 years, I would say. It's really, or maybe the last 20 years. It hasn't shrunk either. The good news is it stopped getting worse. The bad news is it didn't get much any better. So there's roughly the same proportions until the crash. Now, since the crash, of course, there's been a huge increase in the size of the bottom because there are just lots of people out of work. And I think a lot of what we think about inequality is going to turn out to be out of date once we get used to the high level of unemployment that everybody is projecting for the next 4 or 5 years. That's going to make it look more like it looked in the mid to late 70s, except even more so. High rates of unemployment lead to low average incomes throughout the bottom 30 or 40% of the income distribution because people don't work regularly and they don't get wage rate raises and all of that.
This is a country that, of course, has been built on a belief in upward mobility. Sometimes they just say mobility, assuming it's all upward.
Yeah.
there's enough truth to it for long enough that it was a plausible thing to believe. It's not anymore, is it? What's happened with mobility?
The short answer is that in the United States, it's really hard to figure out how much change there's been because the studies we have they're not big enough samples so that you can say with confidence that there's any trend at all. That means there could have been some trend for the worse or there could have been some trend for the better because you just don't have enough people to be confident about what it looks like. And also the studies we have don't all agree with each other, which complicates it even further. The main thing I think you can really say is we used to think we were better than the rest of the world on mobility, and now it's pretty clear that we're not doing as well as a lot of European countries are doing. And those are countries we used to think we did better than.
These are countries with, in American myth, are ossified social structures.
Yes, right. Now, not all of them are thought of as ossified. The Scandinavian countries, for instance, there's a lot of mobility up and down the income ladder, but the income ladder is very short. So one reason there's a lot of mobility up and down it is that a big jump is that you're making 50% more than your father was. Well, in the United States, that isn't necessarily much of a change, but because the spread is so great. But in Sweden or Finland or something, that's a big shift in your relative position. But even Germany and France, there's some reason to believe that there's more mobility there now than there is in the United States. It's also true that what we know about these comparisons is not very, not as reliable as you might hope. It's certainly not as reliable as what we know about the distribution of income in all these countries. So.
The snapshot kind
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
It's, but the lifetime
distribution. Are always easier.
The lifetime distribution is much harder.
Yeah.
To, my impression is that in the United States, people don't travel all that far from their neighborhood of origin of the income scale. Is that true?
That's true as a sort of as an overall generalization, yes. But if you think about this, you could say, well, if we were perfectly mobile, the glass would be, let's say the glass is full then, and then the glass is empty when nobody moves at all or something. If you look at these numbers, you'd sort of say it's about halfway in between. Well, halfway in between means people don't travel anywhere near as far as they might, but they don't stay put anywhere near as much as they might either. It's kind of, there are a few people who travel a lot and a lot of people who travel a little, but a few people traveling a lot offsets a lot of people traveling a little, and it kind of comes up in the middle. And that's true even when you look at, there have been people who looked at kids who grew up in public housing projects. Well, you know, fair number of their children are living in the projects, but an awful lot of their children are not living in the projects. They're living better than their parents were. They're not living in the Ritz or anything, but there's a spreading out going on of a moderate sort for people who start at the bottom. Of course, people who start at the bottom have nowhere to go but up. So if they move, they move up. The thing that we always forget is that when that's happening, there are people who start not at the very top, but people who start fairly near the top have kids who end up considerably worse off than them, too. The very top, there's a tendency to end up, stay at the very top. You can inherit enough money, so even if you mess up your life, your checks are pretty big.
So are ceilings stickier than floors?
A little, it looks like, in the United States. I mean, there's less movement down than up. If you think about it, of course, you think if you're going to compare everybody relative and just rank them from top to bottom, then everybody who moves up, somebody else has got to move down, because there can only 1% of the population is how many can be in the top percentile, you know, and 99% have to be in the bottom 99% and so forth. So each person who moves out of the top 1%, someone else has got to move in, and someone else moves in, someone's got to move out. But we used to partly deal with that by the fact that the rich had fewer children than the poor. So the next generation, there weren't enough kids from the top 1% to quite fill up the top 1%, which made it easier for people who weren't there to squeeze in. But that's been not eliminated, but there's kind of a compression in fertility rates over the last 100 years.
Now, I've been conducting this interview on the assumption that inequality is a problem. Of course, there are people who think it's not. Where do you fall on that?
Well, I set out to write a book about all the problems that inequality caused I started this 12 years ago, I think. And I found as I went along that many of the problems that I had thought from what I read were caused by inequality. It was very hard to find evidence that those problems were caused by inequality. On the other hand, there are plenty of problems that I'm pretty confident the evidence shows are caused by inequality, even if they're not as many as the critics, including me when I started, would have said.
That was the first part of an interview with Christopher Jenks, a professor of social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back with part two of the Christopher Jenks interview after a musical break. That was some of To Hell with Poverty and The Gang of Four in 1982. Now on to part two of my interview with the sociologist Christopher Jenks, who's been studying the issue of inequality for more than 40 years. He teaches social policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Before the break, Jenks was addressing the question of whether and how inequality mattered. He said that he had to rethink some of his earlier objections to inequality when he discovered that the data wasn't there to support them. If it had been me, I'd have said something about how it was distressing that some people are homeless while some have five enormous houses, but I was just asking the questions, not answering them. Here we return to that question. I asked Jenks about the work of a British researcher, Richard Wilkinson, who has argued that inequality itself is bad for health. And if you take two societies at roughly equal levels of income, the more egalitarian society will have better health indicators than the less egalitarian one, because higher equality is associated with greater social cohesion, which is good for your health. Jenks himself can't find the evidence to support that case. Christopher Jenks.
Now, you don't believe the Wilkinson claims on health, right?
I believe there might be some effects, but I certainly don't believe they're anywhere near as consistent as what Wilkinson claims. Wilkinson's story, for instance, tells you that more equal countries have better health. Well, when that claim was first made, that looked like a plausible story because the countries on which we had the inequality data that were the most equal were Norway and Sweden, and they were very healthy. But then the data began to show up for Denmark and Finland, which have distributions of income that look very similar to Norway and Sweden. And Denmark and Finland have terrible health, not as bad as the United States, but quite bad compared to countries as rich as they are. And apparently, both Denmark and Finland have big alcohol problems, and also, at least in Denmark, there's a big smoking problem. Why these things should be happening in egalitarian countries where there are lower levels of stress, according to Wilkinson, is a little murky, but they don't do so well. And if you look at the other side of it and say, what are the other countries that are look very unequal at the top? Well, the Canadian income distribution at the top looks not as bad as the United States, but pretty bad. It's not hard to see why. They have a labor market that's very integrated with ours. If they don't pay their CEOs as much as the Americans do, the CEOs will slide across the border into the main part of the company that's owned by the United States or Canada, as the case may be, but it's a kind of, they have to compete that way, or think they do. But their health is way better than the Americans' health.
They also have universal health care coverage.
They do have universal health care coverage. There's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how important that is, but I think there's pretty convincing evidence that it makes some difference. And, of course, a lot of our inequality measures leave out things like that. We say, well, how equal is one country compared to another? And it's all about money. It's not about whether you get subsidized health care or subsidized housing or food stamps or, all the kind of other things that welfare states often distribute that don't show up as cash.
Parenthetically, the Census Bureau has been doing these supplemental measures of poverty that show that the working class, once you deduct the cost of work and things like that, which are not measured in the conventional measures, are doing a lot worse than we thought. Right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of near poor people in the country who are working hard and have nothing to show for it.
I think that's right, and I think the poverty line per se is not a terribly good measure of anything. Even after you've corrected it, it's not a very good measure because people's expenses are really unpredictable. People have a sick person in the household so that only one person can work. Well, we don't find out all these things that affect what it costs. But if you look at the bottom two-fifths of the income distribution, I think you get a pretty clear picture that the poor and the near poor are really struggling. And these days, since welfare reform, most of those households have somebody who's working. They don't all work 52 weeks of the year because the kinds of jobs they get don't provide steady work in lots of cases. But we're not talking anymore about a large group of people who are living on welfare, except of course for the elderly who are living on Social Security, but and the disabled. Those are the two main groups.
Back to the harms of inequality, what do you think is established?
Well, the one that's the most obvious and the easiest to argue logically, but very hard to prove definitively, is the political consequence. I mean, if you say, why is it that we had a Occupy movement? Well, it's a lot about the perception that people have that I believe is correct, that a lot of the policies that are made in Washington and in state capitals, too, are made to favor the rich. And if you think about, well, why would that be happening more than in the past, it's not very hard to figure out that if the income share of the top 1% doubles and people spend a larger fraction of their income on both supporting political candidates and trying to change public opinion in favor of the ideas that they're in favor of, the richer they get, the more they spend of their income, and their income is going up faster than anybody else's, you're going to have this explosion of spending on political activities by rich people and a decline, relatively speaking, by everybody else. And that used to be partly offset by the fact that the unions provided people who worked in campaigns, and getting people out to, use shoe leather was offset to a significant extent advertising and so forth. But that is much less true now than it used to be. And so the whole overall effect is, I think, a big change in the distribution of power, and it affects both parties. The other thing I think is pretty clear is that you're getting more disparate outcomes for kids, and they're more related to parental income than they used to be. But that's, I think, not as dramatic, and it's not as important as the political effects, because the political effects are self-reinforcing. The more unequal the political power of the rich is, the more the rules will be skewed to favor the rich getting richer. And the more the rules are skewed, the more unequal the power becomes, and you get to a point of no return where it's very hard to go back and say, the voters are sick and tired of this. They can vote in Obama, but he doesn't get a Congress that wants to do what he wants to do, so he doesn't do what he promised to do. And that's partly because the Congress is responding very directly to the people that they think they're beholden to, and including lots of Democrats as well as Republicans.
Well, it also seems like the consequences of failure or mistake or illness or anything are more severe than they used to be, because the poverty is harsher than it used to be. Is what does that do to the consciousness of a society?
It's hard for me to not to believe that when you see people on hard times and nobody doing much of anything about it, you don't get hardened yourself. Introspection seems to me to say that's going to be what happens. If you live in India and you see beggars dying on the street, you get used to it and you don't think about it as much anymore. If it was the United States and you'd never seen that happening, you'd be really shocked. And I think the same thing happens when you pick up the paper and read these stories about the terrible things that happen to people who don't have health insurance or who don't are getting evicted from their homes and so forth. You get used to terrible things. And that's a kind of callousness that I don't know how to measure, or at least I don't know of any measures of it. So you said, can I prove that this happens? Well, no. But I have some confidence in it because I see it happening inside myself. So I kind of believe, well, if it's happening to me, why wouldn't it be happening to other people?
And now moving to the what is to be done question, the always challenging one. A common prescription that people offer for inequality, if they think it exists and is a problem, is more education. What do you think of that?
It can't hurt. I think how much it would help, a little probably. I think that we've got a situation where there are a lot of employers looking for workers who are more skilled than they can find. You never know
what
they say.
What do they mean
that.
By those skills?
Well, that's what I was going to say. I'm not sure always what they mean. Sometimes what they mean is they want somebody who's done a job like this before, and they want them to work at a wage which is lower than that person wants to take. And so they say they can't find anybody. Well,
so they'll import the worker from India.
Well, they might import the worker from India, or they might have the work done in India, or they might spend several years looking for, you know, a source of people, you know, wait for a plant to close someplace, so there'll be a lot of those people looking for work.
Anything would bid up the wage.
Yeah. But I think it's true that the wage gap between college graduates and high school graduates, for example, has widened quite a lot. It's widened a little more even than the overall level of inequality, although not hugely more. And it's very hard to explain why that would be happening, except that it, for whatever reasons, employers prefer workers who are better educated.
Now, how much of that is skill and how much of that is just showing up and being responsible and all those moral things?
I think it's almost impossible to tell. We know it's not skill in the sense of SAT scores, because we have a lot of data that give tests that are like SAT tests to people when they're in high school or in college, you know, finishing high school or whatever. And you can track those people and you see that even if you take account of their scores on those tests, there are big differences in the wages that those people command, depending on whether they finish college or whether they don't, and so forth. So you'd think, well, that means that employers are paying for something besides that. But that doesn't mean they're not paying for skill. They might be paying for somebody who had learned how to do something in particular and did it carefully and was methodical and careful about the interests of the employer and so forth. You say, well, now exactly, is being interested in the interests of your employer a skill? Well, it's kind of what your employer might think of as a skill.
Others might think of it as a character defect.
Yeah, exactly. So, but if you just think of it very broadly as some traits that employers value, which is the way economists tend to talk about skill, you know, as opposed to thinking, well, there's kind of character traits over here and then there's technical skills over there. I think the character traits may be just as important as the skills. You know, people want to find workers who are conscientious and who show up on time and who think ahead before they do something and who are nice to the customers and all kinds of things like that that are not, they're not skills in any standard version of what you're supposed to learn in school, at least.
Now, we're about the only major country in the world where the younger cohorts are not surpassing older cohorts in educational attainment. How much does that matter?
It's hard for me to know how much it matters whether we're surpassing the older cohorts are surpassing the younger ones. It matters from the point of view of one kind of upward mobility, that is the kind of upward mobility in which people just compare themselves to their parents, not to the other people around them. And a lot of what people mean when they say America's not a place where you can do as well as you used to isn't comparison it to other people. It's, you know, my parents lived in a house like this and I want to live in a house that's at least as good as the house I grew up in, and preferably bigger, better, you know, more square feet, two-car garage instead of one-car garage, whatever. And if that's the standard, then I think probably getting more education probably helps a bit in realizing the idea that, you know, I can do better than my parents did. And if that's your goal in life, then staying in school might well be a good idea. But that doesn't do anything much for quality, I don't think. You could imagine that if everybody stayed in school and they all got exactly the same amount of schooling, that wages would be a little more equal. But we don't have any idea whether they would really be a lot more equal or whether people would just start drawing distinctions about, well, this kid went to MIT and that kid went to, you know, Somerville Community College or something. And that, instead of counting years of school, we could count the quality of schools. And people, some people say that's already started to happen. I mean, it certainly happens at the top. But that's been true for a long time.
I'm speaking with Christopher Jenks, who is a professor of public policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard. Well, I think a lot of the people who call for education as the prescription are evading things like tax and social spending policies, which could really make a difference. Is there another option besides that?
The main thing that I think constrained the level of inequality in between, say, 1945 and 1975, or 1970 anyway, besides tax rates at the top, which were a big factor, and social spending at the bottom, which grew quite a bit, was the existence of labor unions. And not all of them did very much, but a lot of them had quite an effect on the distribution of wages in the firms that were covered by labor contracts, and they tended to have an egalitarian effect in the sense that they pushed up the wages at the bottom more than at the top. And the unions then also supported other kinds of legislation which were egalitarian, but didn't, even when they didn't directly influence their members. I mean, they would support an increase in the minimum wage, not because they had very many minimum wage workers, but because they thought that pushing the wages up at the bottom made it easier to push up the wages that were above that, too. And you can kind of, it was a kind of a trickle-up theory of wages, if you will, that if you raise the minimum, then the people who are a bit more skilled than that will get more than that, and so on up the ladder. And as the unions lost membership, that force has not quite disappeared, but almost.
Well, also in the late 90s, when we did see some gains across the board, and the black poverty rate fell to an all-time low, and, you know, there were many favorable developments throughout the income mm-hmm. distribution, that was also a period where the unemployment rate went below 4%.
Yep.
Which is about the only time in the last 35 years we've seen that. So how important is the labor market?
I think the labor market's a pretty big deal. There are two ways you can think about it. One is, well, it's a big deal how long people are unemployed. If you think about the way capitalism works, jobs are always being destroyed, so people lose their jobs. But if the unemployment rate is 4%, they find another job pretty fast, normally. So that there are, the period in which they're not getting wages is much shorter each year, and people who work more weeks make more money. So that's one part. But also, the tight labor markets just push up wages at the bottom over a period of time. Now, how much they push them up depends on how much resistance there is from the employers. But it seems like it's a pretty consistent story that wages are pushed up more when labor markets are tight. Now, it's a hard story to tell with certainty, because it's also true that since the people who are let go when there's a downturn are low-wage workers, it can look like wages rise more during downturns than they do when the labor market's expanding, because during the downturn, the people who are low-wage workers aren't working, and therefore they're not counted as having low wages. If you put them in as zeros, of course, it would look quite different, but we don't do our statistics that way.
To what degree do you think that this Great Recession is caused by this polarization? I mean, is that a contribution to it, and our inability to recover from this recession, even, you know, what, 2.5 years after its official end?
I'm not the way I think about it mostly is that I think that the Great Recession was caused by the same things as the crash, namely sort of letting the rich deregulate themselves and saying, oh, well, the market will take care of everything. And so the same things that allowed people to bet the bank on an upturn and get the government to bail it out when there was a downturn instead are also the things that allowed those people to get extremely rich. Because if you can make one-way bets with banks and they come out well, you have fabulous amounts of money to distribute to yourself. And then when they turn out badly, you can say, well, you got anybody else who can run this bank? And the government says no. And so then you can give more money to yourself. So I don't know to what extent the run-up in inequality itself caused the crash, as opposed to the same things causing both the run-up in inequality and the crash.
Well, the compression of purchasing power in the middle and the bottom, yeah, compensated for by borrowing, mm-hmm, had some contribution.
That certainly has some. I mean, all of the bubbles that we saw, the housing bubble and the credit card bubble, which is less, obviously, and less crucial, but still it's the same story, are driven by the fact that both the fact that the banks wanted to lend and the borrowers wanted to borrow. That's how you get a bubble going. I mean, if the banks want to lend and borrowers say, no, not me, I don't want to borrow, my mom told me that was a terrible thing to do, then the banks are out of luck. That was not the American way. It has never been the American way. So you have a willing buyer and a willing seller for credit, and the sellers are willing to sell it because they figure they can't lose because they'll get bailed out, and the buyers believe that the market will always go up. Why they believe this is partly because nobody reminds them at irregular intervals that it won't, and partly because nobody regulates the markets to see that they actually have the wherewithal to pay.
Nobody wants to listen to a naysayer.
Yeah. So that certainly was part of the story, and maybe the biggest part of the story, but again, it's a story about deregulation. It's also a story about large numbers of people in every income group being overly optimistic and borrowing money and figuring, you know, it'll work out. I tend to think of the number of people who will borrow money foolishly as a constant. But that's obviously not true in one sense. I mean, that is, the number who will borrow foolishly will go up when there's somebody out there pushing loans. And as it goes up, their neighbors will begin to think, oh, well, if he's willing to borrow, why shouldn't I borrow too? He just made a bunch of money on buying and selling that house. Maybe I can do the same thing. So it's a kind of contagion too. And it may be contagion driven partly by stagnant wages. You know, if people want to live better than their parents and want a swimming pool to show that they've done better than their parents, then they borrow some money to have a swimming pool, you know. Or if they're poorer, they borrow some money to have a kitchen with a stone counter, you know.
Do you see any way out of this, or are we still lost in this, in the dominant way of thinking of the last 35 years?
When Obama was running for president, I thought that it was a terrible shame that the Democrats were going to win this election, because the chances of getting a reform out of the disaster, which seemed to be in the making, were going to be much lower if the Republicans had been in office for 1 year during the disaster than they were in 1932, when the Republicans had been in office for 3.5 years since the disaster. And I kept thinking, well, you know, couldn't we just hope that the Republicans won and then the Democrats would win in 2012, and then maybe they'd do something about this whole thing? And then I thought to myself, that's the stupidest way to think about the world. You know, we're going to make things worse in order to make them better. You know, this is not a good way of reasoning. But I must say, in retrospect, I still feel, you know, I don't see how we're going to make this better unless we get a different story about what really happened out there. And I don't see how that can happen in the present political environment. Maybe it can. I hope it can. But as long as we don't really see what's been going on clearly, the chances of putting through regulations and rules that are opposed by almost all the most powerful people in the society seem to be pretty low. That would be really hard to do, even if most everybody agreed that this was the case and only 5 or 10% of the people who were going to lose as a result were opposed to it. But when a huge proportion of the population that stands to gain from regulating these things also subscribes to that theory because they believe what they see on Fox News or whatever, I don't know how you do much about it.
That's the conclusion of my interview with Christopher Jenks, a professor of social policy at the Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University. Jenks has been studying the issue of inequality for more than 40 years, and there are few people around who know as much as he does about the topic. You may recall that I asked Jenks if it mattered that, unlike just about every other major country in the world, today's younger Americans are not surpassing their elders in educational attainment, which will, over time, move us from having the best educated population in the world to having a middling one. He responded mainly by addressing the question of how this might affect mobility across the generations. As I pointed out here before, however, the economist Robert Gordon has argued that this failure to surpass will dampen our economic prospects considerably in the coming decades, contributing to what could be the slowest extended rate of income growth in American history. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of The Oncoming Day by the New Zealand 90s indie pop band The Chills. Seem kind of New Year's-y to me, even if not literally. Happy 2012 to all. Till next week, bye.